Mr. James Clark will present argument for petitioner.
May it please the court, my name is James Clark, the firm of James R. Clark & Associates, Houston, Texas. I represent the petitioner J. Howard Marshall, who was the defendant in the trial court. This is a cause of action arising out of a breach of an employment contract entered into between the respondent Ted Vice and the carpet defendant Nitrogen Carpet Tubing Inc. and Mr. Marshall in his capacity as chairman of the board of the corporation. The initial lawsuit was filed against the carpet defendant. It was amended to bring in Mr. Marshall. A request for admissions was filed by the plaintiff Vice in September of 1986, and these requests for admissions were never answered, and therefore under Rule 169 are deemed admitted. Subsequent to the filing of the request for admissions, the deposition of Mr. Marshall was taken. There was an original set of interrogatories that were filed and answered by Mr. Marshall. A second set of interrogatories were filed and responded to by Mr. Marshall, and a supplemental to those interrogatories were responded to. The trial court, at the beginning of the trial, although no order had ever been submitted admitting the request for admissions, deemed them admitted, and we proceeded to trial, and the trial court ruled that the plaintiff, Ted Vice, take nothing. The first court of civil appeals in Houston reversed and remanded, and we're here before this court on point of error as to whether or not a reviewing court is bound by admissions of parties purported as matters of fact when the record before the court shows that such admissions were not truthful, but opposite of admissions was true. Assuming, and two of the basic requests for admissions were, did the defendant, Mr. Marshall, terminate the plaintiff if the act was a willful and intentional act calculated to damage the plaintiff? The second was the defendant's decision to terminate plaintiff was done willfully and intentionally with the unlawful purpose of causing damage to plaintiff without just or lawful right. The purpose of Rule 169 is to simplify a trial and discovery by eliminating matters that are actually not in dispute, to save the time and expense of the parties in litigation by, in effect, stipulating those matters that are not in controversy. Obviously, a question such as the two that I just stated was an act done willfully and intentionally would not obviously have been admitted by a defendant in a lawsuit. But under 169, if they are deemed admitted, then the trial court has the discretion of determining whether or not the testimony of the party during the course of the trial would refute or rebut those admissions. And in this case, the trial court obviously weighed the credibility of the witnesses, and based upon the testimony and the evidence introduced in the trial court level, deemed that the testimony would have refuted or rebutted these two admissions.
If Mr. Vise had offered the admissions and then objected to any questions by you contrary to the admissions, should the trial court have sustained those objections or overruled?
Your Honor, I think it would be based upon the evidence at that time. I think, again, the trial court, the trier of fact, has that discretion to determine whether or not the objection should be sustained or overruled.
Well, to put it point blank, admission 15 was defendant lacked cause to terminate plaintiff at the time he was terminated. if they offered that admission deemed admitted into evidence, and then you asked Mr. Marshall, did you have cause to terminate him, and he answered yes, and the other side, Mr. Vise, objected to that, should that objection be sustained or not?
No, I do not think it should be. Because, again, I think this goes to the discretion of the trial court as to whether or not the testimony that is brought forward during the course of the trial would rebut or refute any of the admissions that would have been deemed admitted.
Well, what good is an admission if you can testify contrary to it at trial?
I think the purpose of Rule 169, Your Honor, is to simplify the discovery during the course of litigation and to...
Well, it doesn't simplify it if you can admit it before trial and then take it back at trial.
But I think what we're talking about, or at least my understanding of the purpose of Rule 169, is if we're talking about, are we admitting certain facts as to dates, genuineness of documents, things of this nature, and I think that is the purpose, as I understand it, of Rule 169. I don't think the purpose of 169 is to allow a party to ask questions of this nature, in effect hoping that they will slip by and not be responded to, and in effect then being admitted. I think that defeats the whole purpose and spirit of our rules of civil procedure.
How's the trial judge to determine which ones to honor and which ones can be rebutted?
I think it would be based upon the testimony, Your Honor, that would be brought out during the course of the trial.
In other words, admissions have really no effect at all.
No, I don't believe that at all, Your Honor.
Well, then tell me what effect they will have.
I think the effect is that there are uncontroverted facts, that there are undisputed facts. Whether or not a termination of the employee was willful or intentional, I think would be a disputed fact.
If a party admits that he ran a red light, can he take it back at trial?
No.
Why not? Under your theory, why not?
Well, did he admit it when he responded to the request for admissions?
Or by failure to respond?
Well, I think there's a distinction. I think
why should there be?
Because I don't think a party to a lawsuit should be penalized
for not answering the admissions?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So what's the purpose of the admissions? Why have them?
To simplify the...
It doesn't simplify anything. It just doesn't settle anything.
Well, but again, I think, again, the trier of facts in this case, the trial judge, I think, has the responsibility and has the discretion of determining whether a question of that nature was deemed admitted simply by a failure to respond. As opposed to if the request is, or if the is the employment contract dated such and such a date, is the employment contract between the parties, I think things of that nature, there's no question.
So under your theory, a party would be better off not to respond to requests for admissions at all.
Well,
he's got free rein at trial.
I don't think that's correct.
That's what I'm hearing you say. I want you to tell me where I'm wrong.
In this particular case, Your Honor, and I'm not sure the record reflects it, the original attorney of record who was served with the request for admissions failed to respond to it. I was substituted in subsequent to the expiration date of when the request should have been responded to and filed with the court. The defendant, Mr. Marshall, to my knowledge, was never served with these requests for admissions. And I think that's a very heavy burden to impose upon a defendant or a plaintiff in any litigation through the failure of an oversight of one of the counsel penalizing in that respect. And I think basically that's what this is. I think we go back to the fact that the trial court does have discretion.
Aren't you arguing, I guess, in your brief and here today for a broader proposition than you need to win this case? I mean, as I understand it from the record, these admissions had been deemed by the court, but when testimony contrary to those admissions was offered in evidence, there was no objection by the opposing party on the grounds that the admissions precluded such testimony.
I believe that's correct.
Wouldn't that be Well, we'll just speak to that and then what legal policies and trial procedures are.
Well, I think...
To be affected by whether or not one should have to object or not object.
Well...
Offer is contrary to the deemed admissions.
In other words, was there a waiver of the objection? Was there a waiver of the admission?
That words it pretty well, yeah.
I think there was by the failure of the plaintiff to object to the admission of that testimony, which obviously controverted or rebutted the admission.
Were they deemed before Mr. Vise examined Mr. Marshall, or deemed after, or when were they admitted, or what's the record showing?
Judge, I believe, I think at the beginning of the trial, I'm not certain of that.
And then Mr. Vise called Mr. Marshall and examined him contrary to the admissions, and then there was some further discussion about it or not?
There was further discussion about it, but as I recall the trial, there was no objection raised by Mr. Vise as to the testimony of Mr. Marshall.
Why isn't that a waiver?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Why isn't that a waiver?
I think it is a waiver, Your Honor. I think the failure to object acts as a waiver.
This evidence, contrary to the deemed admissions, then was elicited by your opponent.
Your Honor, I'm not sure whether it was elicited by me during the course of the trial or by the opponent, but it came out during either the direct examination or cross-examination of Mr. Marshall during the course of the trial. That is correct. Your Honor, if there are no further questions, I will conclude my remarks at this time. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
Thank you, Court. Mr. Bruce Cohen will present argument for respondent.
May it please the Court, my name is Bruce Cohen. I represent Mr. Ted Vise in this proceeding. I originally filed this lawsuit for Mr. Vise back in 1985 against Howard Marshall and against Nitrogen Coil Tubing Incorporated. Nitrogen Coil Tubing Incorporated later filed for bankruptcy and the matter was severed and the action proceeded against Mr. Marshall. The corporation had entered a 5-year written employment contract with Mr. Vise back in April of 1984. And Mr. Vise was to serve as president of the corporation. He was terminated in September of 1984. Mr. Marshall never answered a set of requests for admissions, and Vise prepared for trial assuming that all requests were deemed as a matter of law and the matters were conclusively established for purposes of trial. In addition to offering the requests at trial, Mr. Vise offered testimony both from himself, from expert witnesses, and he also proved up his damages at trial.
He also examined Mr. Marshall contrary to the admissions, didn't he?
He examined Mr. Marshall. There were no questions asked that would elicit evidence that was contrary to the admission. There may have been some points that were made. Mr. Clark also examined witnesses, and I did object, contrary to what Mr. Clark has said. On pages 55 and 57 of the statement of facts, I objected to the matter as being both irrelevant and immaterial, stating I didn't specify the objection dealt with the request for admissions, but it was irrelevant and immaterial because those matters that the testimony that Mr. Clark was eliciting were already established as a matter of law.
Wouldn't that have been a great help to the trial judge?
It probably would have been better, Your Honor, if I stated that it was because of the request for admissions. One of those objections was cut off, and then the judge interposed and asked him not to leave the witness.
You did object on the grounds that the answers elicited were irrelevant and immaterial?
That's correct, Your Honor.
If you hadn't objected, would you have waived the admissions?
No, I would not have. Specifically, I'd refer the court to the case of Smith versus Home Indemnity Company, 683 Southwest 2nd, 559. In that particular case, there were admissions that had already been deemed admitted, and then following that, there was deposition testimony that was contrary to the deemed admission. And the Court of Appeals in that case held that there was the controverting deposition testimony, but it said that it cannot be used to controvert the deemed admissions that were already there.
And that was summary judgment case.
Yes, it was, Your Honor. And summary judgment was granted in favor of the plaintiff, and the Court of Appeals said that the trial court was correct in refusing to consider the deposition testimony that was contrary to the deemed admission. Justice Hecht, again, in answer to your question, there was no need for an objection. The court could not consider any evidence that would have been contrary to the deemed admission.
So how does the trial court know as the trial is proceeding whether this evidence is contrary to some big long set of admissions that it remembers two or three days ago were offered or not if somebody doesn't object?
Well, in this particular case, the trial just lasted one day.
Well, what if it were a longer trial?
Okay. Even if it was longer, Your Honor, at the time of summation, which I did in this case and which I'm sure would happen 3 days later, it would be brought to the attention of the court that they were deemed by operation of law.
Well, and it's not brought by summation. You've got a fairly short trial. Perhaps it's easy to sit here and say the judge had these admissions in front of her and she should have recognized it, and you apparently pointed out the summation, but we have to think about a rule that will apply to every case, including the month-long case.
Yes, Your Honor. The case was, by operation of law coming in, and after the admission into evidence of the request, we had proven our prima facie case, which could not be disputed by any evidence. And the court can't even consider that evidence. Even if the court allows the testimony to come in error, they cannot consider that evidence in reaching their decision.
You say you argued that in argument to the judge?
Yes, Your Honor.
Was that argument recorded?
Yes, that's part of the statement of facts. In fact, that's what all of the case law says. That's what all the law reviews say. There's absolutely no law to the contrary.
So you're suggesting that if you had admissions offered in front of the trial, evidence contrary to those admissions is introduced during the trial, and nothing is ever said about that, no objection is raised, it's not argued, it's just left there hanging, and then you get findings and conclusions back contrary to the admissions that you can then say, wait a minute, there's no evidence for these.
It's already been established as a matter of law, it's been conclusively established, and it is error for the court to consider, even without objection, any evidence that controverts the deemed admission. That's what all the case law says.
In essence, they cannot be waived.
That's correct.
Counsel, are you familiar with Houston First American Savings versus Music?
I don't believe so.
An opinion of this court in 1963 that says a party relying on an admission must protect his record by objecting to the introduction of evidence contrary to that admission of fact and by objecting to the admission of any issue bearing on the fact admitted. You didn't find that in your research?
No, Your Honor. It wasn't brought up by opposing counsel either.
So you were in, you had these matters deemed admitted at the beginning of the trial. Is that right?
I think I called one witness, and following that witness's testimony, I then offered them into evidence.
Of course, you've been essentially the same position as if there had been an admission in the pleadings of your opponent to the same effect?
I believe so, Your Honor, yes, and I believe the case law said that, too.
You say you called one witness. Who was it?
Mr. Vise. I called other witnesses, too, but Mr. Vise was the first witness, I believe, and then I offered the admissions into evidence.
And your position is you did not examine Mr. Marshall contrary to the admissions. You did not elicit.
I did not elicit it. He may have made statements, even though I had not attempted to elicit it by not properly answering the question.
Well, did you move to strike his testimony then?
I don't believe so, no. the point of error that's before the court today is a reviewing court is not bound by admissions of parties of purported matters of fact when the record before the court shows that such admissions were not truthful but that opposite of admissions was true. The case citing that proposition was not cited in the application for the writ. It's Gore versus Cunningham, 1956 case at 297 Southwest 2nd, 287. That particular case dealt with a situation where the requests for admissions were answered, and it dealt with trespass to try title. And the plaintiff had sent some admissions, and the other party agreed that, yes, the land was properly transferred from party X to party Y and from party Y to party Z. The evidence before the court, however, was that as a matter of law, the deeds were defective and the land was not properly transferred. And that's why in that situation the court ignored the admissions, even though both parties agreed that the facts were correct. The only other two cases cited by the appellant are Gray versus Armstrong, and that's where a witness gives conflicting answers to requests for admissions. In that case, it's for the court acting as finder of fact to resolve the conflict. In that particular case, there were two answers that were given. Again, the requests were answered, but two answers seemed to conflict. And the court in that case said that the court as trier of fact can determine which answer would have been the right answer. Neither that case or the other case that's cited by the appellant, Gordon versus Williams, deals with the request for admissions as a holding. Requests for admissions were just referred to in passing. The other case, Gordon versus Williams, is a 1942 case, and the proposition that it's cited for is that the rules of civil procedure shouldn't be construed to give one litigant an advantage to have judgment without supporting testimony. This is the headnote number two from the opinion, and that language is to be found nowhere in the case. Moreover, Gordon versus Williams had nothing to do with requests for admissions. It dealt with interrogatories. And the words requests for admissions appear nowhere in that particular opinion. So the case law cited by the appellant does not support the point of error. Let me also state that in 1973, Rule 169 was amended to allow a party to file a motion to withdraw the deemed admissions. For good cause, and they would need to show a couple of other things. No motion was ever filed prior to trial, nor was any motion brought up orally at the time of trial where I requested that the court take judicial notice of the deemed admissions. So even though there was an opportunity even at trial to withdraw those admissions, no motion was ever filed by opposing counsel or even raised with the court. In conclusion, I would submit that the decision of the Court of Appeals is correct, at least based on all the case law and all the law reviews that discuss requests for admission. The trial court was wrong, number one, to allow testimony and to allow it over objection and to allow it to become part of the record. And the court was also wrong to allow it to controvert matters that were already conclusively established. Because of the overwhelming evidence of Marshall's liability in the record, both from the deemed admissions and from the testimony, this court should either affirm in all respects the decision of the Court of Appeals or strike the grant of the application for writ pursuant to Rule 181.
May it please the court, I would just ask the court to follow a liberal and a reasonable interpretation of Rule 169, and in cases such as this, not penalize the litigants by a failure of a trial counsel to respond to the request of admissions. In this case, let the trier of facts, the trial court, determine whether or not the testimony and evidence introduced during the course of the trial would rebut or refute the deemed admissions. There are no further questions. That's all I have.
Thank you,
counsel. Thank you.
That concludes the presentation of argument and the second call. The court will take another recess.
Counsel, please rise.